sometimes we get focused so much on the interactions going on with this Iran war and the Strait of Hormuz, now the Bab al-Mandab, and what is that going to do to the global price of oil, et cetera, that we forget there's another war that's also still raging after 4.5 years, and it also is undergoing some changes here and some escalation and some evolution also in where this war is going. And we don't want to leave you hanging on what's been going on there. And so we have with us today to try to talk about some of this, a first-time guest that we've ever had. Nikolai Petro is a professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island. He also served as the U.S. State Department Special Assistant for Policy on the Soviet Union under President George H.W. Bush. Professor Petro is currently a senior Washington fellow at the Institute for Peace and Diplomacy here in Washington, D.C., and we're really happy to have him here for the first time. Professor, welcome to the Deep Dive.
Nice to be with you, Dan.
Well, and just for everybody to know, I actually met a professor in Tbilisi, Georgia on a recent trip there, and we had a delightful conversation over dinner with a number of our colleagues, many of whom have been on this show before. So it's a really pleasure for me to have you on board here today. And let's just get right into it, because a lot of things have been going on. Well, let's look first of all at the Ukraine side, because there have been some pretty big shakeups here. A couple of weeks back, the prime minister was replaced. And then a couple of days ago, we had, as you see there on the right, the defense minister, Fedorov, was replaced. And a lot of people are asking, this is the Ukraine media, by the way, on the right here, is sacking the defense minister Zelensky's biggest mistake yet? And now then, apparently, we're waiting to see if General Sersky himself is on the chopping block, and he's going to be replaced. Talk us over about the general overview. First of all, what is going on with this huge shakeup at the top in Ukraine?
Well, it's interesting to ask why this is happening if things are going as swimmingly as the Western press says they are in Ukraine. Why are we firing everybody? Because that wouldn't really make a lot of sense if things are going well. And the issue seems to be the arch rivalry between the Minister of Defense, Fyodorov, now former, and the current Commander-in-Chief of the Ukrainian Armed Forces, Alexander Sirsky. So they are at, according to the Ukrainian press, at loggerheads and cannot agree on strategy. As a matter of fact, Fyodorov, the younger of the two, at, I think, 35, says that the Ukrainian armed forces, never mind what the Western press says, is in a stalemate. It's in a cul-de-sac. It has no strategic vision. It doesn't know how to win this fight. And if it continues on the trajectory that it has been going, then Ukraine will inevitably lose. And as a result of this coming out and of Fyodorov's efforts to gain personal support from the West, from Western sponsors for this position, Zelensky, the conventional wisdom in Ukraine has it, Zelensky had to get rid of him without targeting him, had to fire the entire cabinet. Because once the prime minister is fired, everybody's mandate in the government automatically ends. So it's a reshuffle of the entire deck. And what makes this unusual right now is that Fyodorov started a little bit of a coup because he accepted his resignation, but the very next day called a press conference and said, this was a mistake. I should be reinstated, and insisted that he should be reinstated and that the real culprit, whom he named in a rather lengthy press conference, was Sirsky, who should be fired. Interestingly, the conventional wisdom is that Fyodorov does not himself want to be commander-in-chief of the military. He's a technocrat. He has big visions about transforming this bloody war and its casualties into a drone war, which is somehow, to his mind, more acceptable. And as a result, he blames Sirski for the losses and the strategic lack of success of the Ukrainian armed forces, and specifically for the funding that is not going to the projects, the drone projects and the anti-ballistic missile defense, the missile defense and the ballistic missile production, which he would like to see. Of course, Ukraine doesn't have that money. It's all Western money anyway. But essentially, if you can think about it this way, the military is fighting over resources, and who should distribute these resources? Who should have the right to distribute them, and who would distribute them most effectively and efficiently? And so far, there's no end to this row in sight.
Well, let's take a look at some of the details of some of the things you just said there. What is, if somebody's thinking either Fedorov doesn't know what he's talking about or Sirski doesn't know what they're doing and they're not going in the right direction, does somebody have a vision for how can a country that is manpower-wise particularly is so much smaller than the Russian side, millions fewer even theoretically to pull from, and then, of course, they're contingent upon the literal existence of their economy on Western influence. I mean, it's like an IV. You might as well have a blood money IV going in there, that they can say that they can outlast in a war of attrition the side that has all its own natural resources and its millions of men that it hadn't even mobilized other than that initial 300,000 that they've been getting it through recruiting. How do they think that? Do they think, sorry, better question, does anybody in Ukraine think that there is some amazing strategy that somebody can find that can reverse this course and push eventually the Russians out so that they can win the war?
I would, to summarize what you've said, what is Ukraine's strategy for victory?
That's a shorter way to put it, sure.
So I would say there are three views on this. One is the, I guess, traditionalist view, the view of most people in Russia and skeptics in Ukraine, which say there is no feasible strategy for victory. Therefore, we need to pursue negotiations and end this as quickly as possible on the best terms that can be achieved. But the priority is not the terms, because we are going to be the losing side. The priority must be ending it as soon as possible. And you have a number of former people now and formerly in the Ukrainian government. I'll just name one person because he's been talking a lot about the need to do this, and he was part of the Ukrainian negotiating team in Istanbul that actually not signed a negotiated end to the conflict, but initialed the draft to that end in March and April of 2022. And so he says, you know, that was the best deal we were ever going to get. And from now on, every delay in signing something like that is going to be worse for Ukraine. So that's one view. The other view is the view that Ukraine has always had, which is, to be most candid about it, there is no Ukraine that can win this war alone. There is the West and Ukraine together that can and must win this war. So our strategy, the Ukrainian strategy, is to bring the West directly into the conflict. The West needs to be convinced. The West doesn't see why it needs to do this. And we're here, and our total strategy must be aimed at making the situation as dire and as catastrophic for everybody in the region in order to get the West to overcome its reluctance to put boots on the ground. That's the only strategy we have. I would say that's the strategy of the person, to name a person who I think pretty candidly thinks this way, is the former head of the security services, Kirill Budanov, who is now chief of staff for Zelensky. He's given a number of interviews in sort of when he was transitioning from one position to another, wasn't sure if he was going to be in government. In government, he basically toes the line. But in the few weeks in between, he had some very interesting positions that basically indicated that he understood the limits of what Ukraine alone could do, and that the solution is to make this the West's war. And they would also, I think the Ukrainians would point to say, and we're winning, we're succeeding in this. We are getting the West more and more, inch by inch, creeping toward direct military confrontation with Russia in Ukraine. So that's our strategy. It's working. We'd like it to work faster, but you know, that's the solution to this.
So these folks who have adhered to that theory actually believe that, no, at some point we can get Western boots on the ground, not as a peacekeeping force, not as a deterrent force, but in an actual combat to help us win the war. They actually think that's possible?
Yes. And once the peacekeepers are there, Russia has said they will be targets and it will inevitably escalate, which is what we want. What we the Ukrainian government in this case I'm talking about, that's the bet. That once they're on the ground and being shot at, there's no retreat. So we need to get them over the line into positions here where they will be targets. And we understand certainly the consequences of this. And the West will be forced to understand it at that point. Because and I want to add to this the third component, which is the Western media political elite. And here the sense is this is still an existential fight for the West. The West must achieve a strategic victory over Russia. That rhetoric has not changed in 4 years. And because that's the strategic, that is the actual goal of Western policy leaders in most countries, there has been no effort to negotiate with Russia on the part of the West. There's not even a negotiating team. There's just nothing. So what the objective here is basically, I would say that the Western strategy, since it doesn't have any other objective except continuing along the lines of providing support, both diplomatic and military and financial, is essentially hostage to Ukraine's broader strategic vision of bringing the West into the war. Because the people in the West, I guess, who are in power now, who support the vision that we must inflict a strategic defeat on Russia, the West must do that, fall into two categories. One is, can it be done incrementally? And at some point, Russia will collapse as a result of our increasing pressure and determination. That's the safer position. And the others, of which there are a number of prominent voices, who say, go all in now. And I'd say the Balts, not so much Poland now, they're divided on their own issues with respect to Ukraine, but certainly the Baltic states, and a handful of other Eastern Europeans, and Germany, France, and I don't know about the new regime under Burnham, but I doubt it'll differ very much. from British policy toward Russia in the past. So they argue that we may need to engage sooner. But the problem with direct Western engagement is we are not yet prepared. So let the Ukrainians die first. Then, after 3 years, more years of that, if we can drag them along, then we'll be in a position to defend ourselves in the West. Whether we will decide to do this defense of the West in a forward position in Ukraine or on EU territory, that'll be our choice. That'll just be our choice. And it'll be, you know, we have all the cards in this. As long as Ukrainians, the government says the Ukrainians are willing to fight and die, essentially for the rearmament of Europe at this point, I guess. So there's multiple levels here, but nobody is really arguing for peace.
Yeah, that is definitely not. Let's look at those second of your three possibilities there. First of all, we'll start with the one you were just on with Europe. Is there, or can you identify an attainable objective for this? Like, if we succeed, here's what the end state would look like. So we're going to work towards that. Or is it just this, I bet it would be cool if we hurt Russia. So let's just go and we'll figure this out in 2030, 2035, something like that. How do you see it?
The question, so there's a lot of literature and media hype about how the Ukrainian strategy, some call it the new Ukrainian strategy of drones and deep strikes, are hurting Russia. But there is no discussion among the supporters of the current strategy about exactly how will this lead to Russia's withdrawal or willingness to accept defeat or even negotiate. What is the connecting link? The question, as you asked it, what will it take? The assumption seems to be that if you just do more of what has been ineffective to date for years, it will transform miraculously into an effective policy without any connecting logic, without nothing linking the two. This has certainly been the argument with respect to sanctions, hasn't it? 20th packet of sanctions, 21st, 51st, who cares? it's just more of the same. My problem with sanctions is not that, you know, they're bad economically. There's lots of economic arguments, but what about on the basic assumption that if you have a policy that is not accomplishing what you thought it would accomplish, doing more of the same is just stupid? Why are you continuing to be stupid about this?
especially when it's counterproductive for your own economy. It's not only is it not failing, or it is failing to accomplish the objective, but it's also costing you to keep trying the same thing over and over. And that's one of the things I was going to say.
Even let's say we're willing to accept that cost, we're still not getting a policy result that we said would derive from this. Where's the policy effect? Where's the result? And by the way, I like, because I did some research on, there's a rich literature on economic sanctions over 50 years old. Scholars have looked at sanctions in all continents. You know, they're not a new policy. The consensus of the academic literature has always been and continues to be that sanctions do not accomplish the political objective that they were set out to accomplish. The percentages of where you can draw a connection between a sanction imposed and a political outcome that you wanted on the part of the person you were sanctioning, you changed their policy, is very, very small. And that's for a whole number of countries, large countries, small countries, wealthy countries, doesn't matter. Because when you put yourself as a sanctioned country in the position of saying, okay, we give up, your sovereignty is over. You have lost, not just today, you have lost in every future discussion with that potential rival or enemy. Because they'll say, you know, well, we know exactly where to hurt you. We know exactly what to do to get you to cave. And no self-respecting country wants to put themselves in that position, no matter how hard it hurts them. And that's what you have to remember. It's not that Russia's super tough or anything like that. No country would allow itself to be blackmailed in this way. The government specifically will endure great hardships not to put themselves and their future generations at this sort of disadvantage in the future.
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, it's illogical. And yet that's what we do on a regular basis, just because I guess it's easy and thoughtless, but it looks like we're doing something. So we seem to go down that path. I want to shift over back to the second part of that. You mentioned a second ago, and you mentioned one particular adherent to the Ukrainian side, that the pathway to victory is to draw the Western countries in on the ground so that their fight, you know, so now it's an allied fight on the ground, not just from support, and Budanov being one of those advocates of that. Have you observed that any of these folks, whether privately or overtly, acknowledge that if you're predicating your future existence on that hope, that's not a solid place to be, because it seems pretty unlikely that even the feckless Europeans are going to go that far to put their troops in a war with Russia that could all too easily would probably go nuclear. So that's a red line for the European side. And if you've predicated your existence on that, then at some point you're going to collapse and not make it. Does that enter their minds?
The alternative is no better for them. The alternative is to be driven out of office and possibly out of existence. For just losing the war. The alternative is losing the war, which would incur not just consequences for Ukraine, but for them personally, from all sides. All the support among the nationalist forces that they now have because they're fighting, all of a sudden, the entire political and military elite, or whoever would agree to some sort of, I would say, even ceasefire, depending on the terms of the ceasefire. But even a ceasefire has been vilified among Ukrainian nationalist forces.
Among Ukrainian forces? Among Ukrainian forces, it's been vilified.
Yes, vilified as an unacceptable compromise. So if the current government goes along with that, they become universally hunted by the Russians, by the Ukrainian nationalists. No one in the middle who just wanted peace is going to thank them for this. Surveys show that Zelensky, if after the war, some hypothetical situations after the war, would you want Zelensky to run for president? Two-thirds of Ukrainians say no, we don't even want him to run. Then some wit added a question for Kiev, so the center of political life in Ukraine, and said, well, what would you want to happen to Zelensky? And 50, I think it was 54%, just over half, said, he should be indicted. That's the current president, for presumably for everything that led up to this catastrophe. But you can't allow yourself to think or to discuss the magnitude of this catastrophe until the fighting stops. So there's some interesting discussions. This will take us a little bit off the issue, but there are some interesting discussions now among analysts in Russia, I think, about what is better for Russia? Would pursuing the current trajectory of a war of attrition, which might last still, well, into the foreseeable future, no clear timeline there, with continued losses, is that better? Or would it be better to agree to a ceasefire and thereby allow the political process in Ukraine to resume? Because everything now is dead. Everything is, as President Zelensky put it, the Constitution is on pause. So, you know, no one gets replaced through elections. There's no recognized political opposition. There are no legitimate public protests. And everything is tightly controlled. Lifting all of that and allowing for the normal political life to begin again in Ukraine would reveal so much of what has happened, so much about who was responsible for the corruption, who benefited from the war, you know, who benefited personally through their families, who escaped abroad with what resources. All these things will begin to come out at that point, and there will be a reckoning that might be more damaging to internal unity of Ukraine even than pursuing the war. So I think strategically you could make a case for both, like stop the war once the declared objectives of the Russian special military operation have been accomplished, which are now only remain. What remains is the liberation, as they put it, of Donetsk and Zaporozhye and Kherson, and then declare that the military objectives have been accomplished, and let the Ukrainians themselves eat each other up in the aftermath of the peace.
That's interesting. There's another interesting dynamic going on inside of Russia right now. It has to do with what should Russia do with these increasing strikes deep into their country, whether it's their energy infrastructure, or whether it's the big wild berries hit, the kind of like the Amazon version of Russia, which had these really dramatic black smoke clouds that were going up in Moscow. And there was two different ways of viewing it. One is from the Ukraine side, and Zelensky, I think, was the one that was pushing this on his social media, on his X account. And he said, hey, fine, we're bringing the war to the Russians so that they see that, you know, there's a cost to this. And so they see the only way to end this is to come through negotiations and have some, you know, basically end on my terms, et cetera. That's his view. Well, there's this interesting here from Yuri Podolyaka, who has long been one of the kind of the leading war bloggers in Russia. And he's saying, hey, you know what? We should actually rejoice at these arrivals, as they call this incoming fire. The strikes of the armed forces of Ukraine on the wild berries are only good for us. This is a big plus because this way more Russians will be involved in the war. He's saying, yeah, to an extent, he's actually agreeing with Zelensky, although for a very different reason. He wants, and a lot of people agree with him, that they want the Russian population to wake up and realize they're in a war and they have to do a lot more. So it's not making Russia want to get out of the war. It's making Russia want to go more into the war and fight harder. How do you see that dynamic?
This used to be a lot of money, I remember. The $64 million question, I guess it should be $64 billion question now. What will have an impact on the Russian government to change their perspective? What is it? And it's really no different from the things that we were talking about last, like a few minutes ago. Will the sanctions do it? Will the deep strikes do it? Will targeted assassinations do it? All these things have been tried without very much effect. And the latest version or the latest addition to those strategies seems to be a strike on a public target that can, that has a very visible effect, a big plume of smoke, something that is very visibly dramatic, because that can sell in the West, and through the Western media, it gets distributed back into Ukraine and into Russia. So I don't know for sure. So there's two views. One is Podolyakov's view, and the other is the view of advisors close to the Russian government. So the advisors close to the Russian government, or supporting the current war of attrition, would highlight how minimally effective these strikes are. The strikes on refineries reduce refining capacity temporarily. At worst, a few weeks. There's nothing that sort of destroys the entire refinery capacity. Indeed, in June, so that's last month, Russia's energy export revenue increased to its highest level, because instead of exporting refined goods, they replaced it with raw oil, raw crude, I guess. And they exported more of that and let the refining be done elsewhere. I assume that's not as profitable, but Russia has so much of the resource that it can make up the losses in different ways. So even the reduction in refining capacity, for as long as it lasts, has not impacted on revenues significantly. Now, what about, and the strategy, what to do about it? Well, multiple things, I guess, is what Russia would try to do, is try to point out, well, this is an annoyance, but not decisive to our war effort or these bottlenecks that are occurring in the energy distribution system. This allows us to work out the kinks in this energy system and figure out how to defend, how to make it more resilient. And of course, the last strategy, about which we all know the least, because this is where the technological innovations come fast and furious, is what strategies can now be put in place that are anti-drone, anti-ballistic, that can undermine the communications network. This is an ongoing tit-for-tat battle. And for every advantage that one side or another has for a number of weeks or months, it never lasts. By the way, this is a common view among the Ukrainian military. I think both Sirsky and Fyodorov, if they agree on anyone, on anything, it has been that technological advantages can be a window of opportunity for a short time. But in the long run, the other side always catches up and does something different that we then have to adapt to. And it's just a vicious circle. Meanwhile, you know who the big losers in this are in terms of technological innovation? It's the West and the Europeans, because all they get to do is to watch and not implement. And of course, to have an effective system, you can learn from other people's mistakes. But then you have to be there, you have to implement it, you have to work out the kinks, you have to do the production of it and see how it works in the field. And Russia and Ukraine are both doing exactly that. So whatever else may happen as a result, Russia's and Ukraine's armed forces are getting that battlefield experience, which is making them more formidable and increasing the gap between the military capability of NATO and the EU and Russia proper, who is the ones that they're trying to defend against.
Yeah, that's obviously not really good from our perspective. Can you best you can ascertain or project what is even theoretically possible? Forget it for the moment about whether they have the resources, the Ukraine has the resources, but if they could have unlimited resources and do whatever they wanted, not personnel, because that is a fixed issue, but if they could have whatever they wanted technologically, is there some application that could actually cause Russia to politically say, all right, it's actually in our interest to just have an end to this war, let's end it on the current line of contact, and we'll live to fight another day, we'll figure this out some other day. Is there even a theoretical possibility that the Russian government would come to that conclusion?
I don't see any realistic wonder weapon. I mean, the term came about at the end of World War II to describe an imaginary force that the Germans would use to halt the ongoing Allied offensive, and that would strike such terror in the hearts of the Allies that they would agree to a ceasefire rather than the unconditional surrender of Nazi Germany. But I think this is more in your bailiwick. I'm not a military person, but I don't think weapons work that way. I think weapons are always imperfect. They're tailored to specific tasks. And if you had the kind of weapon that could not be defeated, well, we wouldn't be that far from the end of the human race then, because somebody would want to use it to make sure all the bad guys, and there'd be a never-ending list of, ever-enlarging list of those bad guys to use it against. One of the reasons that Star Wars never got very far was that, if such an impenetrable shield could be accomplished, everyone else would be at risk. And what would the argument be for them not launching a preemptive strike to prevent it being deployed? To prevent being permanently in a hostage situation in international relations. Yeah. So you would never want anything like that.
The reason why I asked the political question, because militarily there is no such weapon. You literally just a minute ago defined the vicious cycle of an advancement, a retaliation, and then a diminution, and then a new idea, and then vice versa. It just keeps rolling through, and it doesn't really have a lot of impact. Any of these things have had, because it's just continued on throughout. The dynamic stays about the same. I do not see, and that's why I was asking you, I don't see any political way that any kind of weapon or usage of existing weapons or drones or missiles or anything else could cause a calculus change in the Kremlin that would allow them to come to the conclusion to end this war. And so to me, the only thing that it would do, if there was that advance in capability, technology, a new application, whatever, that was putting the Russian at risk, then I think all they would do is ramp up what they would do and fight harder and then bring into the potential use nuclear weapons.
Right. I think the actual example of something that exists as a weapon that could be given to Ukraine, theoretically, is what if they were given nuclear weapons by the West to use against Russia? And what if maybe they were given them in two tiers? So tactical nukes first, which could be used regionally, to show that the capacity existed to strike inside Russia against smaller targets with nuclear weapons, and then immediately reveal that Ukraine had a nuclear weapons at their disposal, which they could use to strike cities and military targets. What would the response of Russia be? I don't think it would be surrender. I think it would be an all-out strike, nuclear preemptive nuclear strike against Ukraine to end this capacity. That's what I think with almost with certainty would happen.
That's certainly how I see it too. And the consequences of that realization are profound, because that almost is whatever Budanov and any of these Zelensky, any of these other guys think is their strategy to draw in Europe. Even that would not achieve victory. It would not push the Russians out. It would only make the Russians ramp up or use nuclear weapons. Therefore, logically speaking, it is an unwinnable situation for the Ukraine under any circumstances. And to continue on would almost mean that instead of surrendering, as you put it earlier, where they had a negotiated settlement that was on terms acceptable to Russia, which would be really bad for the Ukraine, would be viewed as a victor, as a defeat by anybody. But that is better than the alternative, which is to lose anyway, not through a signature, but through the physical destruction of your country eventually. I don't see any other alternative. Do you?
That is the sensible argument for ending the war as quickly as possible, because there is no plausible scenario whereby Russia would accept defeat. But there is an argument that could be made to say maybe Putin's Russia or Putin and his entourage would not accept defeat. But what we could do is destabilize through all of these things that we've been talking about, and Western media and propaganda mechanisms being effective in Russia, we could destabilize the political situation there. And as a result, Putin would be removed somehow. So he would be removed. And if Putin were removed, and that would be the immediate objective, to remove Putin, then, we are not able to predict exactly what would happen, but we would at least have some additional levers to try to influence Russian policy. The counter argument to that, or the problem with that, which I think has been demonstrated by a number of political commentators, including some close to the present regime, but critical of it, like Sergei Karaganov, most notably, has been to say, well, if you get rid of Putin, you'll get someone who isn't as restrained as Putin has been to date. You could, instead of a war of attrition, mobilize a million men without probably, you know, it would be possible, and launch an all-out military campaign, which would overwhelm the Ukrainian military much more quickly and make it a real war rather than this slow drip of in which Russia, at least it argues, is trying to save lives. It's trying to save its own soldiers first. It's trying to decimate the Ukrainian armed forces, but to the extent possible, allow for civilian targets to be maintained. I mean, all you have to do to convince yourself that this is indeed Russia's strategy of saving as much as possible civilian casualties, preventing civilian casualties, is to compare the civilian casualty rate in the war in the Middle East that Israel is involved in, and this war in Ukraine. The numbers are four or five times higher civilian casualty numbers in Israel's campaigns in Lebanon, Syria, and Palestine, than they are to date for a longer conflict in Ukraine. And the numbers of people that we're talking about in Israel are, you know, 10 million plus, and whereas in the case of Ukraine, it's 20, 30 million. So it's really a horrific comparison.
Yeah, it really is. And this does is show that there is no rational, viable path to any kind of success, however defined, on the Ukraine side, that doesn't more likely end up in the destruction of the Ukraine state, as opposed to trying for the best ugly deal that they can get. I just don't see another way, but I don't see any willingness in the West to do it. I don't see any willingness in the White House to do it. And I certainly don't see any in Zelensky's government to do it.
Which is why I've argued since I wrote my book in 22 that the solution here is for Ukraine to negotiate directly with Russia, because all the intermediaries have their own agendas first and foremost. Anybody in the West is out for the West's interests. And they're, of course, going to say, well, we are with you, et cetera, as long as you continue to fight. So what Boris Johnson came and allegedly said to Zelensky when the latter was willing to sign on the dotted line in the Istanbul Peace Accords, that you may be ready to stop fighting, but we Europeans are not. And let's fight instead, because we'll have your back. We'll give you everything you need. We're here for you. And of course, he lied. He lied. And he probably did so knowingly, because no politician at his level can make that kind of commitment for the indefinite future and for future governments. So he didn't actually know what he was committing to when he said, we are here for the indefinite future, or words to that effect, which has been the constant refrain from Western political and military leaders. But in fact, it has been a lie all along.
And I was going to actually ask you, I'm glad you brought that up about your 2022 book, The Tragedy of Ukraine, seen here on Amazon. What classical Greek tragedy can teach us about conflict resolution? So what is, just real briefly, what is the tragedy of Ukraine that you wrote? Because this is 22, so this is the first year of the war. And what does that tell you about today? You wrote this in 22. What does this tragedy of Ukraine tell you about today?
Yeah. Well, so I used tragedy in the classical meaning, how the Greeks saw it. And it was, for them, tragedy was a political discipline. It was a way of teaching citizens responsibility for their actions. If you don't take responsibility for what you did wrong, then the consequences will be that you will have to do it over again, or the people who come after you, not knowing what was done before and what was tried, or will have to relearn that error again. So tragedy involves learning from your mistakes. And I said, I identified from the very beginning that there are three levels to this conflict. One is the conflict between the West and Russia over where Ukraine should lie, where Ukraine's allegiance should lie. The second conflict is between Russian and Ukrainian elites over who the Ukrainians are. Are they separate from Russia? How separate? How different? Can Russia tolerate an anti-Russian Ukraine? That's been going on again 30 years and more. But the big, the biggest tragedy, where the biggest conflict has always been, and at the root of the other two problems, because those are fed by the internal problems of Ukraine. And this is the conflict that has always existed between East and West. It's not a simple conflict, and I recognize that it's not as simple as saying East and West, but there are, and have for a century and a half at least, been Philo-Russian populations, predominantly in Eastern Ukraine, and Philo-nationalist, Ukrainian nationalist populations located heavily in the four Western regions of Ukraine, and regions in the center, which kind of go both ways, depending on the political context. So they've been fighting on and off about who gets to determine what it means to be a real Ukrainian. And they've been fighting about it politically. They've been killing each other about it during previous world wars and during this war. And until that internal conflict gets resolved, where Ukrainians of all stripes, Russian speakers, Ukrainian speakers, Orthodox, Greek Catholics, all these stereotypical divisions which every Ukrainian knows about, gets resolved, and they learn to forgive each other everything that has been, that the other side has, they say, done to them. And they come together and say, let's create a government and a nation of national unity. Let's try to work out a common vision of our future. Until they do that, there's little hope.
Yeah.
There's
about as much hope of that as the Israelis and the Palestinians are going to come together in a big kumbaya moment, too. So not real optimistic, but very realistic. So as always, we're very, very appreciative to have this kind of view. And we thank you so much for coming on and sharing your insights. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And we will be back with you guys literally in just a few minutes from now. Suleiman Ahmed has recently had an exclusive interview with the Iranian Foreign Ministry, among other interviews that he had while he was in Iran. He's got some really keen insights into how that side is thinking and what we may expect in the war coming forward. Tune in just in a few minutes on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. See you then. You know we don't have sponsors because we hate to hit you over the head with ads. I don't like them. So show a little love back. Subscribe, like, and send this to somebody you care about.